Robatto. Dopo arigato, Mr. Robatto, manda arriva te. Dopo arigato, Mr. Robatto, itsu hoshirita.
Okay, and we are back with another episode of the Puma Venture Capital Podcast. Hey everyone, this is Amit Hazan. I'm the founder of Puma Venture Capital, and I'm really excited for this conversation we're going to have today. It is with Kurt Azarbazin. He's a 39-year med tech veteran. He's been all over the place. He led the development of over 90 products in his career, but about $1 billion in sales of those products to date. He was at US Surgical, Tyco Healthcare, and SpineWave, and Respimetrics and SurgiQuest, and spent a couple years at Verb Surgical and J&J. And most recently, he has headed up EndoQuest Robotics. And EndoQuest Robotics is the most recent investment for us here at Puma VC. So we thought it'd be a great idea to bring Kurt on and talk about both his background and this very exciting company that he's now leading. So Kurt, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Yeah, really excited to have you on. You know, Kurt, I thought what we could do is really start at the beginning and tell us a little bit about your upbringing, where you're from, and where you grew up, and all that good stuff.
Sure. Yeah, I grew up in an all military family in Tehran, Iran, until I was 15. And then moved to US. I was fortunate to live with an American family, which was a very good friend of ours that had the sons my age. So I was just really blessed to have them welcome me. And so I moved to a small town in Illinois called Normal, Illinois. I went to high school in Normal, Illinois. And then eventually went to college in Bradley University, you know, just blessed to be part of that family and just learning the culture and everything about you know what it takes. You know, I can't thank them enough. To this day, I still call them mom and dad, and the sons, brothers. So we're really close still to this day. And then from there, and around that time, my dad had escaped from Iran and had come to U.S. You know, as you know, that it's a shame what's going on with that country. And so he was he moved, when they moved, they decided to move to Connecticut because they had a lot of friends and they liked Connecticut as a state. So that kind of forced me to move to Connecticut, and that was 1983. And so I moved to Connecticut and actually met my wife there, and been in Connecticut since 1983, so almost 40 years. And that led to me actually starting my job at US Surgical, because as you know, US Surgical was based in Norwalk, Connecticut. So I started at US Surgical in 1983 as an engineer.
Wow. Okay. So the starting at US Surgical, or the move from college to this, I imagine a first job, roughly speaking, was there an interest early on for you in healthcare and medical technology in some way, or was this kind of one of those just fortuitous turns in life?
Yeah, it was luck. I say I've been a fortunate person all my life from the beginning. So it was actually by luck, because I had an evening class and one of our professors was actually consulting for US Surgical, and we hit it off. I hit it off really well with the professor, and he said, "Look, you know, there's a startup. There's this company that's growing ridiculously, and they're working in this field that's really unique, and you know, you're interested." And I'm like, yeah. So I actually started off doing part-time work with them as a technician, and you know, through the connection of my professor, and then just absolutely loved the field. You know, just absolutely, you know, became a sponge and enjoyed it. And then eventually they offered me a full-time role, and that's That's all she wrote. And from there, it was like, I am working 18-hour days, 7 days a week for the next 10 years. Because, if you remember the late 80s, mid 90s is when the big boom of the laparoscopy was happening. And we were launching products left and right. We couldn't keep up with the demand. And then it was just exciting time.
Yeah. So what were you doing there after you became full time? And I guess we should tell folks, how long in total were you at US Surgical? And then what were the various positions you held there?
Sure. So I was at US Surgical for 21 years. I started out as a manufacturing engineer, kind of in charge of lines, production lines. These products are sterile, so these are sterile production lines. So I started out as just an associate engineer, became an engineer, senior engineer, manager, director, senior director, and then vice president. And then eventually my last role was global vice president of R&D for all of US Surgical portfolios. As you know, US Surgical was a big, big, big innovative company that was that had presence all over the world. So yeah, I have to say, I keep saying lucky. I've always felt like I've been so blessed to be part of such a huge organization, but learn a lot. It was kind of by doing. People ask me, why do you think you're successful? I say luck, number one. Number two, hard work. And then number three, just really enjoying what I was doing with working with surgeons hand in hand. That most of my best friends are surgeons because I grew up with them and I built really good relationships and the trust factor. And that was just a blessing to be part of that. Very few times in your life you could say, I really enjoyed my life. I really enjoyed my job. And that's what it was because I was so blessed to be part of changing surgery for the better. Laparoscopy was a huge, huge, huge plus, and then stapling and all these other things that we developed with surgeons hand in hand and launched and was able to just be part of that.
Yeah, it's so interesting. I mean, you really got a front row seat to this emergence of laparoscopy, as you say, in the 80s and 90s, and I can't imagine how much you learned through that process. And so if my math is right, we're in the early 2000s, and that's when you end up leaving. Tell us what you do next.
Yeah, so honestly, Tyco bought US Surgical, and out of the 19 vice president, there was two of us left, me and head of operations, and it just wasn't fun anymore. Tyco was an acquisition machine, and there's innovations was being lost. So I had Leon Hirsch, the CEO of US Surgical, had taken care of all of his vice presidents, and we all had golden parachutes. So I pulled a golden parachute and decided to take some time and figure out what I want to do next. And as I was doing that, a lot of folks reached out to me and to do consulting work. And one of those guys was Mark Leguidas, who was the CEO of SpineWave, which is a local company here in Trumbull, Connecticut. And so as I was kind of getting my arms around what I want to do, I said, sure, I like Mark and I like Spine and everything I've done working Spine. So I joined him as a consultant. And, luckily, again, as I always use that word, luckily, there was a lot of interactions with venture capital firms. My project, I reported to the board. So the board got interested in, what I was doing and how I functioned. And they reached out to me, some of them, and say, look, in venture capital, we invest in people and technologies. People are more just as important as technology. So we'd love who you are. If you ever want to do something, on your own, let us know. And that's exactly what happened. I always had a dream when I was at US Surgical that I wanted to change access in the field of laparoscopy. I felt that access was not optimized and that it was being kind of not innovative. It's just been the same thing forever. So I formed SurgiQuest in the basement of my house with the dogs barking and my wife screaming with all these people. Who are these? All these people in our driveway and all that. So we had six of us started Surgiquest, which was technology for access, and so and then we went out and fundraised and brought our first round of financing, and 10 years later we were doing, you know, close to 90 million in revenue in 40 different countries, and then we sold the company to CONMED, and that was 2000 and 16, 15, 16, yeah.
2016, right. Okay. And great success again. And this wonderful experience as an entrepreneur, true entrepreneur, which is fantastic to hear. And I'm probably skipping around a little bit here, but, you know, eventually a few years later, you find yourself as the CEO of Verb Surgical, the combination of J&J and Google, the joint venture that was working on their robotic platform. Can you maybe just tell us how you landed at that position?
Yeah. Again, it goes back to luck. So I don't know if I ever shared this with you. So I became when I sold SurgiQuest as part of the sale, I had to stay with CONMED for 2 years, right, as contractually. But then things went really well with CONMED, and they said, look, we're just going to make you whole. Why don't you become our CTO? So I became CTO at CONMED, and I enjoyed it for a couple of years, but then eventually I was missing the startup component, right? And so I started looking, and a good friend of ours, which you know very well, Fred Mall, reached out to me and said, hey, look, you know, I want you to come run Auris. You know, help me get Auris to market. And I said, yeah, sure. So I went out and met with Boris folks and met Josh and Fred and all those guys, and you know, started doing my due diligence, and things were going well, and then all of a sudden it went really quiet, and then Fred then the announcement comes out, you know, where the company got sold and everything. So, you know, I texted Fred and said, hey, congratulations, sorry, you know, we didn't get a chance to work together. And he goes and he immediately texts back and says, no, you're part of the equation. I'm like, what? He goes, no, you know, you're part of this equation. You know, this is, you have to do this with us. So that's when I started actually communicating with both Fred and J&J. And what we thought was appropriate was that for me to run Verb and let them digest the acquisition of Auris. Because as you know, Verb didn't have a CEO for a while, and so I stepped into the CEO role. But interesting enough, I was the only person that had also visibility to Auris, because they had drawn a line in the sand saying, okay, everybody Verb on this side, everybody Auris on this side until the acquisition is final. But I had a visibility to both because I was hired to run Auris pretty much, and that's really how the Verb thing came up. And by the way, when it did come up, you know, the dream job, right? Having Google and Johnson & Johnson put together a joint venture, you know, with some of the best people I've ever worked with on Google campus, by the way. The original Verb facility was the original Google buildings in Silicon Valley.
Yeah. Very exciting. And it was a fairly short stint. You know, I don't know how much you can say, because we all know a little bit about, you know, the challenges and some of the setbacks they've had there, and how, you know, J&J end up kind of is swallowing that entity. Maybe say what you can about your time there and how it ended.
Yeah. So, you know, I joined them, and clearly what I said was, it was like supervising rich children, divorced children. You know, the people just had really no leadership, right? But they had a lot of resources and a lot of dollars, and so I, you know, coming in with a startup background and mentality, immediately kind of rebuilt the team, brought some new people on, and aligned the team for V&V, validation verification, and put a target, right? Because it had cool technology, amazing people, but there was really no structure. So we built a structure around and focused on that. And as a matter of fact, we were able to, and I have the pictures to prove it, we actually got our V&V approved on the Verb platform. And then as soon as that happened, J&J decided, rightfully so, to acquire the joint venture from Google and turn the Verb platform into their entire robotic portfolio, which was Auris and some of the other things. So that was an exit, right? I had shares of Verb, so that became an acquisition, and so most of my team benefited from that, and they got their exit, and then now they were part of the Johnson & Johnson digital and robotic organization. So success. I mean, in 18 months, I turned this thing around and got it to a V&V approved. As you know, V&V approved, that means you're ready to now file your IDE for the clinical study. But obviously for Johnson & Johnson was they had so many different components, so they had to make sure that, you know, they're paying attention to all the assets and come up with the right portfolio. So my job became the global head of robotic and digital for Johnson & Johnson. And I did that for, I don't know, for 3 or 4 months, I want to say, but I just, big company wasn't me. You know, Verb, I was a CEO, you know what I mean? I had control, even though I had a board, we conducted business the right way, you know, and that being part of a big company just was not my forte. And so this opportunity came up, with EndoQuest robotic, which was a dream of mine for 20 years, a dream of most of your partners at Puma, especially the surgeons, you know, doing scar-free surgery is a dream of all of us. It's been a dream of us for all time, and so that's why I then was able to negotiate an exit with Johnson & Johnson to allow me to go and run EndoQuest Robotics.
Yeah, yeah, very interesting. Thematically, clearly you're an entrepreneur at heart, and that shows. And I'm going to plant a flag here. One of these days, we're going to come back and do a podcast about J&J and their internal workings and what went right and what went wrong, because I could easily segue here and do 30 minutes, but I won't. We'll stay on topic. So you join Colubris at the time, and now it's named EndoQuest Robotics. Let's start there, and right at the outset, let's just tell folks what we mean when we talk about flexible robotic surgery.
Yeah, I mean, so, you know, it's truly ability to access existing lumens within the body and actually perform procedures within those lumens, right? So upper GI, transoral, through the mouth, you know, ENT, you can work around the mouth, and you know, then esophagus, and then eventually in the stomach, upper GI. So that's kind of one path. The other path is lower GI, transanally, you know, all the way, you know, to the colon, and to perform procedures there, transvaginally through the vagina. These are all existing orifices, and then transumbilical, which is through the umbilicus or through a small incision. So the advantage of this platform was the fact that it was miniaturized. You know, it's 18 millimeter OD. It has multiple instruments, steerable camera, working channels for inserting things and removing things. But more importantly is that it's flexible and is long, and you could get in access to almost anywhere in the body. And it's just been a dream for all of us to be able to do truly scar-free surgery, which is through existing lumens, and then eventually do the least invasive surgery, which is through a single incision, but a small diameter, right? Truly today, single incision has been around. You and I have been watching Intuitive for a long time. Intuitive launched their single incision, I think, in 2006. And it just really hasn't taken off until recently. And I think the reason why it hasn't taken off is large. It's, you know, 25 to 28 OD. Very rigid, you know, instrument and access device. And then the limit, they have limitations in length of their devices, how far they can achieve, and they're not flexible, they're rigid. So I think that for us, A, going through existing lumens, upper GI, lower GI, transvaginal, it's a no-brainer. But then eventually doing less invasive procedure with significantly smaller footprint, with less scarring, but also ability to access maybe deeper. I've had people from thoracic surgeons come up and say, oh, can I fit it through the ribs? You know, I've had people, you know, talk about, you know, can I do it around the neck? I mean, there's the tunneling and things like that. So unlimited, I think, capabilities from this platform.
Yeah, and you touch a lot of things there. I would probably emphasize one of the last points you made, because I think certainly in our diligence, one of the things that excited me is that it seemed like every time I talked to a surgeon, they were excited, not just about the indication that you're going to be going for that we'll talk about in a few minutes, but about something else, about how they can use this technology in a way that really is innovative and new because of its capabilities. But I want to step back for a second, make sure that folks that maybe are not as familiar with the different surgical tools have an understanding of where you fit in. And I think you did a good job talking about rigid instrumentation and, you know, Da Vinci, Intuitive Surgical's Da Vinci-like platforms, or, you know, we can use the SP, the single incision platform that they have, you know, kind of on one side of the spectrum. You know, I always think about the other side of the spectrum as being kind of some combination of either Intuitive and J&J's Ion and Monarch, respectively, which is a kind of a catheter-based system that might be able to do some procedures in the future. It's doing more diagnostic procedures at the moment, but that can change in the future. And then thinking about a typical endoscope, and right. Maybe that's where we should spend a minute, is, you know, how you're different than an endoscope that's on the market today.
Sure. I mean, as you said, so, you know, robotics is dominated by Intuitive for the right reason, right? It is the most powerful thing out there. It's the most robust thing out there. And their platforms, as you say, there's three platforms, a multi-port platform, and then the single incision, and then they have the Ion. And so for me, I'm not going to go anywhere near that, right? These guys just dominate, right? They're ahead of everybody by 25 years, and they have the most amazing machine that's going to continue to innovate, you know. But this endoluminal piece, which is what we're going afterwards, is something that has not been tapped. Is a market that is, you know, untapped. And number one, number two, it's actually is addressing unmet need. Right. So, you know, all of these things that Intuitive has been doing, all of the robotic companies, they're just doing it better. Right. So, you know, Multiport is doing laparoscopy with robots with more precision, better access, better visualization. Right. But it's not enabling any procedure. It's just doing the same thing better and more effective. Same thing with single incision. You know, you're going into this, you know, making a big incision. It's a call it a balancing act. You know, do I do multiple ports, or do I want to put small ports, or do I want to put one single big port in, right? Where with us is you putting no ports, right? You're going through existing lumens, right? Just like, as you said, just like a colonoscope or endoscope, with a flexible, what we call it, an overtube, flexible overtube that has a visualization component, and you manually go to where the disease is. If it's in the esophagus, and you visualize it, and then you dock it to the robot. Once you know where you are, you dock the robot, and then now you're sitting behind a surgeon console and actually inserting your instruments in. And these instruments are just like, you know, your hand, left hand and right hand. You got graspers, dissectors, shears, and they have 7 degrees of freedom, just like Intuitive does. You could absolutely do surgery now. Where today, if you put an endoscope or colonoscope in, yes, you still can visualize where the disease is. And there are tools within the endoscope or colonoscope that can do some of those procedures, but you're not doing surgery. You're really doing, you know, what I would call intervention. Like, you know, you're trying, because there's no means of traction and counter traction. Surgery is all about, you know, lift and cut. traction and counter traction, lifting, you know what I mean? And you don't have those capabilities because you're working with flexible, instruments that are straight. And they don't have the 7-degree freedom. They don't have those capabilities. A, B, they don't have the triangulation, what we call the ability to actually visualize a disease and be able to do surgery. And then if, God forbid, it's an issue, like a perforation, or you go through some, you have a bleeding or whatever, you know, today you use cautery or you use these clips that sometimes fall off and they're just not really optimum. Where with ours, you can actually suture, you can throw suture and knot tie and actually close the perforation or the bleeding. It's just a game changing platform.
Yeah. So, I mean, I'm going to try to summarize some of this and we'll get into details about a couple more aspects of what you described. But so the physician is sitting at a physician console. So now we're thinking kind of like Intuitive Surgical, but it's an open console, not like Intuitive's immersive one. There's a patient cart, but we'll leave that to the side. Right. As you said, there's kind of this steerable over tube, which is kind of what you call EndoDrive. And that is, you know, kind of similar perhaps to, you know, what you might see in kind of the endoscopes that are on the market today. But here's where, you know, the differences, you know, start to really show up, where in, you know, an endoscope, you've got a camera that is fixed to the distal tip and very limited. You've got maybe one other channel where something can come in, but that instrument really doesn't have the power to do what you call surgery. And then we compare that to what you have, and you've got inside of an 18 millimeter over tube, now you've got the video scope that in your case can be moved and driven, and you've got two channels to be able to drive instruments in, and these are going to have the degrees of freedom and the strength to be able to perform all these kinds of surgical tasks, such as suturing. Did I get that about right? Or would you add anything to that?
Absolutely correct. You know, the biggest aha difference, though, is that when you have a GI doctor sit behind our console, right? Because, you know, that's who uses the endoscope or colonoscope. It's not a surgeon usually. Usually it's a GI physician that initially does your does your scoping, right? So, and they do, as you say, sometimes do interventions. The first thing they say when they sit behind our robot and start actually test driving it, they do this kind of puzzle look like, wait a minute, I have a left hand. Yeah, I can use both hands. Right, because typically, to your point, what you just said is endoscopy or colonoscopy. One of your hands is holding the holding the tube. The other hand is moving the knobs that go left and right, and or inserting these, you know, straight flexible instruments that can really do much. But they're sitting behind this thing, and the left hand is not being utilized. So now all of a sudden they have two hands, and this whole concept of lift and cut, traction and counter traction, the idea of suturing, knot tying becomes really aha moment for them. So that's the only thing I would add, is that it's just absolutely, not only they're sitting behind a console looking up, but they're actually using both hands, which you want, like I would want. I would want whoever's treating me, I want them to have as many tools and as many aids to perform the procedure.
Yeah. I think that's such a helpful point. And I probably will clarify one other thing that you said that I think is important if people missed it, which is if you're comparing to Da Vinci SP, you know, that diameter that you described, I mean, Da Vinci is anywhere between 25, 28 millimeter. And that has created a lot of issues for them as they try to introduce their product with single incision. Whereas with you, you know, obviously, we're talking about natural orifice. We're talking about no incisions at all. But even if you did single incision, we're talking closer to 18 millimeters. Is that right?
Yes, exactly. And 18 millimeters, and this is the other big piece of it. Please imagine this. Because it's a flexible platform, right? Our OD is 18, but it's a flexible platform. It's not a rigid platform, because you're going to be manipulating that constantly when you're doing single incision surgery. When you are rigid, big size,
as you're manipulating and maneuvering, you're also elongating that hole, right? That you've created. Where when you're flexible, you're not really moving at the incision size, you're moving inside the body. So you're not elongating that incision, right? You're not making the incision bigger and not, you know, pushing, pulling against it. I think that was the other issue that the single incision, again, by the way, it's not just intuitive. There are other single incision platforms. That's one of some of the issues that was surrounding it, because the herniation and the actual size of the incision was a big deal, where we hope that for us, it's this tiny, small incision, but we don't make it any bigger as we perform a long procedure.
Yeah, that's great. That's really helpful. So let's talk about how you're going to prioritize using the system. And we've talked about lower GI transanal. We've talked about upper GI transoral and transumbilical with a single incision. So and even transvaginal. But I think let's bring it to kind of where we are. What markets are you going after first, and why'd you decide that?
Yeah, so we're going after transanal first, the lower GI, because it was the simplest way for us to get FDA approval. As you know, all the robotic platforms have to go through a 510K, de novo 510K, which requires a specific indication and a clinical study. And we felt that the lower GI, was the simplest way to gain our approval. And also, that's what the company was working on when I joined, right? So, you know, there was a lot of work that had been done already there. I mean, obviously, upper GI is the single biggest market for us because of the esophagus, stomach, and the GERD and bariatrics. I mean, you know, enabling all that stuff is just huge for us. But because you know, time to market is so important, A. B, once you get your de novo 510K, your initial de novo 510K, all your future filings will be a 510K, because you could use yourself as a predicate device. Today, you know what I mean? There are no predicate devices, right? So that's the other reason why we said, okay, get the lower GI done, get into the market, and then right behind it, file for the upper GI, and hopefully it'll be a much faster timeline. It won't be a de novo, it will be a regular 510K, maybe with clinical study, which will be, you know, half the length of a de novo, hopefully.
Okay.
The rationale. But you know, one thing that I wanted to tell you, I mean, this is the most powerful thing that I've seen in the last 6 months. As we show this platform, it's not about the lower GI, the upper GI, the single incision, transvaginal. You know what's happening is the world of surgery is starting to evolve, and you have GI physicians and surgeons partnering together and doing combined procedures. I can't tell you the power that our robot brings to that to that market. I had Dr. Nin Nguyen from UCI, who's chair of surgery and one of the top bariatric general surgeons in the world, and Dr. Chang, which is the head of GI for all of UCI, came to our facility, and these guys today work together, right? Surgeon and a GI doctor work together hand in hand to do all these combined procedures. I could not get either one of them off the robot. I mean, like, they were fighting each other to get on the robot. And both of them are looking at each other and say, if we had this, our procedures would be so much better. Our timing would be so much better. You know, so to me, it's this whole other market dynamic that we're seeing evolving, that the GI surgeons, GI doctors and surgeons are working together to do these combined procedures that our technology would absolutely dominate. Absolutely. They were ready to use the robot tomorrow if it was approved. And that, by the way, something that we continue to see, which is completely enabling, right? It's just really impressive.
Yeah, that enabling point has been important to us at Puma too. Just, I don't want to belabor it too much, but what's one example of that combined GI doc and surgeon procedure that
they do a lot of esophagus work, GERD work today? Where some of the parts of the procedure is done laparoscopically, and some of it is done through the endoscopic through the esophagus.
Okay.
Mostly, yeah. But there's ton. There's weight loss procedures. There's a lot of things that's being done that our platform can happen make it happen. Right now they're working on it, but when they saw it, oh my God, I can do this with that. Oh my God. Oh my God. The word, oh my God, continue to come up, because some of these procedures are happening today, but some of them they're developing and they're working on.
Yeah, that's great. And I do want to come back in a few minutes. We're going to come back to the GI doc versus the surgeon as it relates to your market development strategy. But I want to just kind of stick with where we were going. So we're going to go after lower GI first. How much visibility or how much can you share about what the study is going to look like and, you know, rough timing that you're hoping for to complete that study and perhaps get on the market in the US with your first indication?
Sure. So it's 40 patients and we have four sites identified. And the sites are two sites are surgeons and the other two sites are GI physicians, Cleveland Clinic, Mayo Clinic, and then we have Harvard, and then we have Advan Health as our four sites. Two surgeons, as I said, two GI, 40 patients, 30-day follow-up, and it's a lower GI study, sigmoid colon.
Starts next year.
Starts. We hope that it starts sometime beginning of next year.
Okay. All right. That'll give people some idea of how long that might take with everything we know about FDA to get on the market. But not too far away. Very exciting from our perspective as investors. We're not waiting too long to potentially see this thing come to market.
Yeah, I would say our plan is to start second quarter, because as you know, it takes a long time to get studies up and running, sites up and running. So we're starting that dialogue now and with FDA as well. We also just filed for the STEP program, which is really significant for us. It gives us expedited review and gives us a direct access with FDA. They actually recommend it. We do that. So that we think is going to help us also shorten the timeline for current filing and future filing.
Okay, fantastic. So let's get to your thinking. You've got so much experience here about how this thing could get rolled out. And we can talk about some of the challenges too, in terms of what reimbursement and that landscape looks like right now. But I'd love for you to do that in the context of discussing the different surgeons or the different doctors, I should say. So the GI docs who could clearly, as you say, have, you know, tremendous amount of interest in the system, but then also the general surgeons and so forth, who are going to have some interest here too. So you're coming in for the first time now with a product that we see that is going to, you know, run across both of those specialties. You know, what do you do about that? And how do you think about it from a business standpoint, where reimbursement today looks a little bit, you know, different in those channels?
Sure. First of all, you need to hear this. This is really important. We just did a study with Harvard where we took novices, 11 GI physicians, we're all novices, and did a direct comparison with standard ESD versus robotic ESD. So they train on the standard tools that are available today, and then they train on ours. And the results, I mean, was ridiculous how good it was. You know, our study had no perforation. The other study had like six perforations, and the time was 1/3. And I was actually there in the lab. And interestingly enough, you look at these new guys, look back once they get on the robot and look at me and like, why am I doing the other thing? Why am I not learning on this? Like, you know, why is this not available for me to learn on this versus, you know, do this other thing where I'm only using one hand and I'm standing, you know what I mean? So I'm sorry, I had to say that, because why it's relevant to answer your question is that our customer, our initial customer in the lower GI is the GI doctors, right? Colorectal surgeons see the patients after GI doctors cannot treat them. You know, and that's the thing that bothers me, by the way. If I have a disease growing in my colon, I want it out ASAP. I don't want the GI doctor to look at it and say, oh, well, you know, maybe I can treat it. Come back next month, because you know, I thought this was just going to be a diagnostic procedure. Or I can't treat it. You got to go see another GI doctor. And that GI doctor says, oh, no, this needs to go to a colorectal surgeon. I want the first person, doctor that sees me to have the confidence and the tools to treat the disease as quickly as possible. So we all, GI doctors are our first, target market. And our hope, and the reason why we're doing all this work is to do two things. One, we've invested heavily on simulation. We will have simulators by end of this month, and all of our sites will get a simulator before they start their sites, clinical study. And we hope to train GI doctors in skill sets that they need to feel comfortable with doing surgery, because they're not trained to do surgery, right? They're trained to do endoscopy and colonoscopy. So we're going to focus heavily on that. Number one. Number two, from a dollars, from a dollars and cents. I apologize. Intuitive, when they came out, it was $2 million and the procedure cost was higher and the time was longer. And that's why they took so long to penetrate and grow. Rightfully so, they just had to prove themselves. We're not playing that game. Our hope is that the first 2 years, we're going to do a lot more what I would call placements, where we're going to place the robot and charge per procedure. But more importantly, we're trying to keep our procedure costs equivalent to what they do today. So if you do an ESD and it costs you $2,500 per case, we're going to try and to be very close to that. So this is, there's no barrier, because at the end of the day, as you know, I don't have to tell you, it's the C-suite that makes a decision on acquiring a robot. It's not the surgeons or the GI doctors. You have to justify. And for us, we want to have a win-win-win-win scenario when this is presented. It's, wait a minute, it's faster, it's safer, better recovery and equivalent cost. And so that's really our strategy as we build all the work that we need to do to get specific CPT codes and payer codes that we need to do, which takes time, as you know. Sorry, yeah. Long answer to your short question, but we've been thinking about this a lot. It's really critical for us to make sure we have that right.
No, I think it's really important discussion point about something that's not too far distant future. So just for those who may not know, When Kurt talks about ESD, we're talking about endoscopic submucosal dissection, really talking about, resections of precancerous colon lesions in a less invasive manner here in this case. And so Kurt, as you think about, we just kind of take the business perspective here and let's just, hypothetically say that the product ends up getting used both by GI docs in their facility, and then also in an outpatient facility by general surgeons. And let's assume you're charging the same for your instruments. What does the profitability look like in both of those settings if we kind of just thought about what the reimbursement looked like today for both of those settings? Is it better in the outpatient setting?
Well, I don't have the answer. I we're getting our arms around it. But what I will tell you, though, you and I both know what costs hospital, length of stay, complications, outcomes. So those are the things that are tough to measure, but they add up, right? And I think what we are learning, and this is early for us, is that every hospital position themselves differently from a payer side. So the ones that getting the maximum pay are the ones that are doing a lot of homework up front with the insurance companies and with the payers. So they really make sure that they have the right relationships and communicating in advance of what the procedures are and what codes they're going to use. So it's kind of not 100% across the board. We're learning this, but we will know it by the time we launch.
Okay. Yeah, and I imagine some of the complication for you is partly because you're also thinking about inpatient procedures that can become outpatient procedures, right? I mean, something like a colectomy, which is currently also being used potentially for things like cancerous lesions in the colon. Your technology could potentially be used for that in a much less invasive, quicker manner.
Well, absolutely. But no, I'm talking about perforations. I'm talking about if you have a perforation, now what do you do? now you went in for a simple colonoscopy. Now you got laparoscopy or open surgery. And now you're staying in the hospital longer. And these are things I'm talking about when it comes to measurable things, you know, from a C-suite standpoint. You know, I want to make sure that I'm not only faster, safer, but I want the least complications. And we think that's a huge upside. I mean, you look at the data, perforation is a known thing that you have to deal with, right? And as you know, when that happens, most of the times you have to convert to either a laparoscopic case or open, because now you're introducing, you know, to the abdominal cavity where now you have an issue. So it's a lot of pluses on our side if we do this right.
Yeah. And it's an interesting discussion. I mean, at the end of the day for us, and I know for you too, what's clear to us is that you have a platform that is incremental in both of these verticals. And therefore, you know, over time, what we're going to find, I think, one way or another, is that surgeons are going to want this, patients are going to want this, hospitals are going to want this, and the reimbursement will eventually kind of work itself out to where it needs to be if it's not there already, as you say. So that's pretty exciting from my perspective. And I appreciate that color. That's really helpful. I thought we would end by, you know, just talking a little bit about the team. We talked about you a lot as heading up this team, but how much can you tell us about the rest of the individuals there that you've either brought on or that were on there when you joined, and how you feel about the team at EndoQuest?
Oh my God. Yeah. I mean, it's all about the team. You know that you've heard me say this. I'm blessed. You know, we have industry veterans that know device and robotics very well. I say that all the time. Don't even bother doing a robotic platform if you don't have that under your belt, right? You need to have people who've done it before, have stood up robotic platforms before, have very clear understanding of what it takes. So in every area, so, you know, quality and regulatory, I brought in John Magnasco, who was with me at Verb, and before that, you know, 10 years as Intuitive. So he's been an absolute rock star for us. And then we brought in Perry Genoa, who was with Titan, you know, and before that with a number of other startups, just an absolute, absolute rock star, again, leading my R&D for me. And then we brought in a number of folks in the operations side who have deep understanding of robotics and things like that. So all in all, I am done. I told my board last month, was like, this is a dream come true, because I really have the team I need. It's just now a matter of execution. And you know me very well in this. The other part of the team that I'm blessed to have is people like Vip Patel and the surgeons that I work so closely with that have been instrumental in my entire career. And today they're even more important. So we do work with them. You know, we just did a 2-month study with AIRCAD in France with the gods of surgery in Europe. And these studies are going to come out soon. And then we did the same thing, that study with Harvard. So those are all partners that I consider part of my team, right? They're either scientific advisory board members or clinical advisory board members that we tap into and work very closely with.
That's fantastic. Yeah. And I probably, you know, would be remiss not to say that for us here at Puma Venture Capital, I think we've got 5 surgeon venture partners who are also involved with your story. And I've known you for a good number of years, and over the years got the chance to see your developments at the very least at every SRS conference. And so it's been so fun to watch this story develop and to see you take over and bring it to where it's at. Our surgeon venture partners obviously absolutely love the product, and it was such a great time to talk to them about this and get comfortable with the story. And we're excited to be investors. We're grateful that we became a part of your story, and we'll be close with you here all the way through to wherever it goes. So Kurt, I really want to thank you for joining the podcast, and for everybody listening. I appreciate you all. We're grateful for you guys being our investors, and we'll wish everyone an early happy Thanksgiving. Kurt, thanks so much.
No, thank you. And I want to say, you're not getting off that easy. I'm tapping into you, my friend. You are an asset to us, and you are a powerful part of our team. So you'll be hearing from me. So thank you again for everything.
Can't wait to help.
All right. Appreciate it.
All right. Take care, everyone. Thanks, happy Thanksgiving.
Bye-bye. Thanks.